Okay, lecture six. Testing, okay.
For those of you who were concerned about problem two, the word joint characteristic function should be interpreted this way. It's a function of two real parameters, S and T, and they both appear here. It's not a single parameter times the sum of X and xn plus yn. Last time we were together, we were talking about an integral e to the minus c summation n equals 1 to infinity x squared over 2 against our presumed measure was zero, whereas the integral of the presumed measure was one. I indicated that this was a statement that we could not conclude from this that the support of this measure was here unless we said this is a finitely additive measure, not the good kind of measure. I want to give you a second argument today for that. Let's take a limit of this expression as c goes to zero from the positive side. This function is always bounded by unity. So if this was a true measure, the dominated convergence theorem would allow us to take that limit inside, which would give us this answer down here, which would be 1, and the limit of 0 is certainly not 1. So this thing violates the Lebesgue dominated convergence theorem as a second proof that this thing is not a true measure, but only finitely additive. Finitely additive.
Could you explain a little bit why it's called finitely additive? Does that have anything to do with finite sums, or is it just some arbitrary name?
Right. So let me work over here. A measure is a non-negative countably additive set function. So take the real line and take various sets A, B, C, D. Call that S1, S2, a lot of these. Let them be disjoint. So the intersection of those two sets is empty if J is different from K. Then the measure of the union of those sets is the sum of the measure of the separate sets. And the marvelous thing is this can involve an infinite number of sets. That's where the infinitely additive phrase comes in. This is countably additive. A finitely additive measure will fail on this situation. We saw that in our primitive example. Remember, we introduced a measure we called tau of x, which was defined as the limit as L went to infinity, 1 over 2L, is L to L, f of x dx. This measure did not pass several tests. For example, we saw that f of x equal e to the minus a x squared, where a is positive. This thing is certainly everywhere non-negative. Nevertheless, f of x d tau of x was zero, but that did not imply that f of x was zero, as it should have for a traditional measure. Let me now talk about this set business. Let me integrate over little blocks from N to N plus 1 in that thing. And I will call that interval tau sub n. That is the, here is my function, h of n of x, which does that. So this is hn of x, e tau of x. That is a 1 and 0 is picking out an interval in the line. So that's picking out how much measure there is on that set. We'll call that tau sub n associated with that. Now, the question is, if I take a countable sum of those tau n's, is that the same as tau over the union of all of those sets? I'll call it simply hn of that. But you'll see that that is nothing but tau over the real line. And that is the number 1 everywhere. Well, the number 1 everywhere here gives me the answer 1. But since this hn has a finite interval and 0 outside, the integral for each of those is 0. Just put that in here. That thing's going to stop accumulating after I get beyond that. So each of these is 0. The sum of those zeros does not equal 1. But it is true that if I took finitely many of these and stop my sum here with some finite interval, that would be finite interval, that would be 0, and that is 0. So it is finitely correct, but not countably, not infinitely correct, not arbitrarily, at least infinitely correct. Okay, so that's the situation for that. We will find a countably additive measure over here, but it is not one for which this is true. The last thing we wanted to talk about was in our combination, we had a b over a 2 pi to the n by, to an infinity actually, and then e to the minus b summation 1 to infinity x n squared over 2, and product n equals 1 to infinity of dx n. We already found that this was either 0 or infinity or perhaps 1 if we were lucky. This thing is essentially 0 all the time, because we have now concluded that xn squared summation is infinity almost everywhere. So that brings us down to a brief discussion of this quantity. Is this thing anything like a genuine measure? And the answer is no. N equals 1 to finite number. D is, okay, that's a good measure. And it has the property, for example, if I integrate 0 to 1, D, x1, dxn is simply unity, of course. I'm trying to keep this up for people who come late. If I integrate up to c, where c is less than 1, then that is c to the power n, which has the virtue that as c goes to unity, I recover the whole space. So it's like I take a part of the set. Let's draw it in two dimensions. I can do that easily. Here's 0 to 1, 0 to 1. Here is my limitation c. My volume in this interval, as I increase it out to the edge, will give me the volume of the total. But if I do that for infinitely many situations, how do I write that? That's very hard. Okay, limit n to infinity of the finitely many fellows. Limit of n to infinity of c to the n, but that is 0 for a c less than unity. And there is no way for that to go to 1 as c goes toward 1. So that's a bad actor. Okay.
This kind of continuity of the measure is something we would require from one of its definitions?
Sure.
I don't understand. I thought that you wanted that the limit as n goes to infinity, as the number of dimensions in your integral goes to infinity. I would think if you're integrating over 1, you should get 1. And you're saying here that you've got 0 now?
Well, it's not equal to the integral from 0 to 1, 0 to 1, dx1, dxn, limit as n goes to infinity.
Right, it's like, what is 1 to the infinity power?
It's 1.
It's 1. Right? So then why do you have 0? I don't understand that.
Because
C is less than 1. Why don't you just pick C be 1?
Well, that's not the question. I want to test the test what happens as I enlarge this out to fill out to 1.
Right.
We can also take the limit C to 1.
Say again?
If we take the limit of C to 1 and then C to the n, or to
W. Well, the two limits don't commute. If I took this to 1 first and then went to n to infinity, I would get unity. If I go to n to infinity first, I get 0, and then whatever c does, it doesn't count.
So you were asking the question, what would happen if c was less than 1?
Yes, of course. Oh. There it was. Okay. So let's take up the question of the support properties. Section 3.2. We found that this is not adequate. What can we say is adequate? Let's look at xn squared times our measure. Well, that's xn squared b over 2 pi to capital N over 2, e to the minus b sum from 1 to n. Xn squared over 2 product 1 to n dxn limit n to infinity. So that's really nothing but the moment of one of these particular variables. Now don't confuse this n with that n. That's a summed n, this is not a summed n. So all we have to do is compute one of the integrals itself. That's not hard. I show you one little nice trick for that. This is normalization of that, so we can put it below. I'm going to change the symbol here from b over 2. I'm going to call that alpha. We have alpha x squared dx in the denominator, that's our normalization. Then we have x squared upstairs, e to the minus alpha x squared dx. Let me calculate this as simply as I can to show you that integrals can be done again without evaluating them. That's the whole point. So this is d by d alpha with a minus sign of the natural logarithm of e to the minus alpha x squared over 2. E to the minus x squared dx. Checking that, it means when I take a derivative with respect to the natural logarithm, I bring this in the denominator, there it is. In the numerator, I have this and I take a derivative with respect to alpha, that brings down a minus x squared, and I cancel the minus squared. This quantity, minus d by the alpha of logarithm, I'm going to change the variable. So I will let alpha x squared equal y squared. So I have e to the minus y squared, and the dx is a dy divided by a square root of alpha.
Dr. Clark?
Yes?
All this stuff with interchanging the limits and getting different results, this is all for Riemann integration, but if you use, is there a way to define it, that integration over low bag measures?
Well, we are eventually, but at this point, the question of this thing, whether I go C first or N first, is totally independent of how I got to where. Okay, so this is a decomposition of the logarithm of the product of these two terms. When I take the derivative, that's the derivative with respect to alpha, sorry, I take the derivative of the alpha that involves only this term and not this term. So this term is going to give me zero in that derivative. So this is the same as d by d alpha logarithm of square root of alpha. D by d alpha, the square root comes out as a half. So that gives me 1 over 2 alpha. So that's the answer. And I haven't calculated it in integral. That is to say, I haven't summed up the area under any curve. Now, our alpha was b over 2. So our answer then is 1 over b. So that is this integral here. So summarizing the top and the bottom of those equations says, let me put a p squared to separate it from the other guys. That the second moment here, or the integral of this coordinate squared, gives me b, which is independent of the coordinate I've chosen. Well, it's perfectly natural because all the coordinates have been chosen.
Isn't it going to be the same answer for any dimension n? Because you convert to this spherical polar coordinates in each dimension, you get the same answer.
Independent of capital N?
Yeah.
Well, don't forget, I have only used one of these variables because the others, the independent variables, have integrated to unity.
So you want only one xn. You are not actually computing the sum x1 squared plus x2 squared.
We are about to.
So let me introduce a sequence, special sequence, if you like, of coefficients lambda n, which are all positive. And that the sum of the lambda n's from n equal 1 to infinity is finite. In particular, lambda n equal 1 over n squared would work, e to the minus n, but not lambda n equal 1 over n. That doesn't convert. So I say that the sum of the lambda n's, n equal 1 to infinity, p, xp squared d mu of x is equal to 1 over b times the sum of the lambda p's, which is finite, but since this is a sum of positive quantities, it doesn't matter how I order them. I will either get finite or infinite. And so I can interchange that order. And I have this consequence. The only way this moment can be finite is if the sum of the lambda p's, xp squared, p equal 1 to infinity, is itself finite almost everywhere in the measure. So our measure has two properties we found out so far. The measure where the sum of the squares is finite has zero value, measure set zero, whereas the measure where one of these lambda n sums is finite is unity. So that will help us understand a little bit of the characterization of the support. So this is our first look at support of mu, and notice, molto bene, it's independent of B, independent of our choice of this Gaussian parameter here. We'll come back later and take a second look at that and find that the support, a tighter support, actually does in fact depend on B. But at this point, let's turn our attention to characteristic functions. For finite n, we know that e to the I summation n equals 1 to capital N Tn xn, e to the minus b summation 1 to n xn squared divided by 2 dxn is our characteristic function, which is e to the minus t summation Tn squared divided by 2b. And here we observe something useful. The xn's, the set of those, are fixed or determined by the support of mu. We don't have a control over that. But the set of t's are free for us to choose. So let's choose them wisely. In particular, looking at what's coming, let's assume that as we increase the number of degrees of freedom, we do it in such a way that the sum of the t squares is finite. Then, the limit as t goes to, as n goes to infinity, gives us this infinite sum. Interpret that as the characteristic function of this quantity. We'll talk more about that later, but let's for the moment take that as given. And it is, since we've arrived at this formula, if you like, by means of a limit of characteristic functions, then we can say that the limit of the finite number of the mu's has given us our final mu as n went to infinity, but in the sense w, the weak sense, which was associated with the characteristic functions. This was associated with the limit of characteristic functions. I will come back a little bit later and put a little more meat on this sentence, more information, but for the moment, let's take it as it is. Well, let's look at our relationship. We have found the support of the x's where they live. They live under these conditions. We have a condition for the t's over here, for the left-hand side to exist. The question is, what has that done for us with regard to this term in the middle? Is this term in the middle well-defined? Is summation tn xn well-defined? And the answer is no. The tn's are square summable. They can only be well-defined with other square summable sequences. But our xn's are not square summable sequences. They have this weaker property. We have to restrict to get a well-defined e to the I summation 1 to infinity t n xn. We must restrict the set of t's at our disposal. Not a big restriction, but enough. So we want this sum to be well defined. How do I ensure that? Well, let's look at its bound. That's less than the bound of the individual terms. That's equal to a breakup of the terms into separate little compartments, like this, using the square root. And then I use a Schwarz inequality. This is like two vectors. Remember, A dot B in your calculus in magnitude is less than the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B. Same thing. We're going to use the same thing down here. So this term is less than or equal to the sum of these guys squared, square root, times these guys squared. If these terms are finite, then I am guaranteed that my sum is well defined. Well, instead of insisting that the tn's belong to this family, which my characteristic function suggests they could, I will limit them to this family. Restrict tn's in this manner, so that this is finite. If this sum converges, then it is a candidate to be a lambda. The lambdas were already positive. My absolute t answer, yes, sir?
Why do we need that to be well defined, e to the I, t and x n? Because in the spirit of distributions, couldn't we just choose to measure the support of the measure to be finite where that whole function doesn't blow up?
Choose the support of the measure, Muller, Gaunt. If I choose the support of the measure, then I could choose it to have this thing finite, where it doesn't blow up, where that's finite. Right? Right?
Yeah.
And I'm barking at you because in the last 6 years there was a huge, thick paper in which people effectively said, this is a measure and I will choose the support to be where this thing is finite. But then, okay, then you're not getting a countably additive measure. You're not getting a true measure.
Okay.
And for me to put the words even finitely additive measure together, ugh, makes me a little sick. The word measure is such a beautiful concept. So give it this finitely additive garbage any recognition by calling it a measure is a mistake. Okay. So this is like a lambda. And this is exactly the criterion for the lambda convergence.
That those things were finite almost everywhere. So if we restrict our lambdas, then we guarantee that our sum is well behaved. So this term will be well behaved, this term is clearly well behaved, and our measure is well behaved. So all terms, all components, well behaved. When the sum of the t ends by themselves in absolute magnitude converges.
Are there any cases that you've left out by choosing this?
Cases of what?
For instance, are there a special case where you can choose tn so that the sum of the absolute value is not less than infinity, but it still satisfies criteria we're looking forward to?
So for the recording machine, the question is, again?
That's a necessary criteria. Is it sufficient?
Well, we have guaranteed that
this is sufficient. You want to know whether it's necessary.
The other way, yeah. I'm a physicist.
Is it necessary? Well, if I can display points in the support, this is where we know the support is. The support is not here. But if I can display points in the support which will have given me trouble here, then I would say I've answered your question, right? So what I have to do is to show a sequence xn which is like this, which you presumably want me to do. No. Which is like this, but a tn which is like this. You want the tn's to be like this, and you want the xn to be like that. No?
Yeah.
Thank
That's
you.
Right.
I pay this guy occasionally.
It's right.
Okay, so tn like 1 over n to a power alpha, xn like 1 over, well, okay, like 1. This would be a place in here in which this would be true. And, right, all I need to do is that. And so my Tn xn would be a summation of the 1 over n's, which is divergent, although the summation of the Tn's, the summation of 1 over n squared, which is convergent. That relate to the question?
Squared.
Hello?
Yeah, you missed square on that last equation, the tn squared.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. So I think that relates to a counterexample that's in the support, but the tn cannot live in the whole world.
So the tn's don't satisfy this criteria, but they don't satisfy that criteria.
That's correct.
But they still can act as support.
try it one more time. The TN example I've chosen did this. This was the largest we could make the characteristic function happy by having a TN squared, which was square summable. I gave you that. But then I told you there's a point in the measure where this thing is ill-defined. Now, what would your response to that be? I'll pay you again. Come on.
I'll let it go.
I don't know quite what else to say to you. Okay. Now the question arises: have we lost? You ask if we lost anything. I thought you meant, and this would be a natural question. Have we lost anything with regard to the maximum possible set of t's for which the left-hand side is intrinsically defined by itself, irrespective of that, if we limit these guys in this way? That's what I thought you were asking.
What was his question?
And the
That was his question.
That was your question. Oh, well, the answer is certainly no, because I can take a sequence of Tn's, which are in L1, that's what this is called, that's the space of functions L1, and so we'll call that J as the sequence. And in the norm of the L2, which is what this one is called, that one right there, I can go to any sequence you like, so call those T, capital T. That goes to zero. I can do that. I can approach. That's self-evident. All I have to do is take any sequence that you're worried about over here that I haven't yet met and stop it at a finite number. At finite number, then it will automatically be true that this sum is finite, and then I take the sequence of those, building that out, and that square sum will approach the right value. Okay. Okay, but that's an important issue that I'm willing to give up the full definition of this C, its maximal extension, in order to make content this term in the beginning. And as we've argued, that does not at all lose anything from here, because given that restricted set, I can always complete this, include, and find out what its values would have been. Okay. Now, let's start a second question about tighter support conditions. So we've already nailed this one to the wall as a support condition for the problem. Let's go back to our previous calculation, which was that xp squared d mu of x was 1 over b. What we did before was to sum that, here's still on the board, with a set of lambdas which had their own property that they were, sum was converted. Now I'm going to try to do it a slightly different way. I'm going to take a sum from p equal 1 to capital P and divide by capital P. And that's going to be a sum of this quantity. Again, if each of these terms is 1 over b, and I'm just doing the average of that, the answer will ultimately be 1 over b. Again, it's a sum of positive terms. So I'm going to bring that, well, at the moment, it's a finite sum, so no problem. And this is true for any finite value of capital P. So let's take the limit. In a way, that kind of looks like one of these. It's not exactly a sum of this kind, but if I throw that away, it's the sum from, if I have p terms and divide by p, it's kind of one-ish. So no big surprise there. More interesting is the following calculation. Let us take the sum, same sum, well, sorry, I'm doing is bringing this back to the other side, if you like, and I'm now going to square it, which we did not do before, and take that integral. Okay, as I square out this term,
there's going to be contributions where, well, let's just write it. There's a summation of P and Q, integral x squared P, x squared Q, the measure, minus 2 of the cross terms, P summation P equals 1 to capital P. And then I have 1 over V, and then I have x squared P d mu x. And finally, I have a 1 over B squared sum, just a 1 over B squared. This, the middle one's easy, because each one of these, we've already determined, is 1 over B. And I take the sum of those, the average, that's still 1 over B. I have minus 2. I have minus 2 over B squared plus 1 over B squared. That's a net minus 1 over B squared. So I have 1 over P squared summation PQ to P. This first term, I'll break into two kinds of terms. One where P equals Q, and the contribution when P is different from Q. That's not on the integral for God's sakes. Here, there are P terms of finite magnitude divided by 1 over P squared. So in the limit that P goes to infinity, this is going to lose. This term is going to disappear because it is order 1 over cap P. This term is 1 over P squared. This is not equal to a total thing, but the terms that are missing, the diagonal terms we are taking care of up here, will be negligible if we like to modify them. In particular, when P and Q are independent, then each of these calculations can be done together. It's just like multiplying another term beside it. So this is 1 over B squared from this term, minus 1 over B squared from that term, and in the limit, as P tends to infinity, I get 0. Important, you understand this. This is a finite contribution, but it's of order 1 over P. This is a finite contribution, which is equal to 1 over B squared minus something which is of order 1 over capital P because of the diagonal terms. Okay, so what have we learned? We've learned the limit as P goes to infinity of this integral, summation or average 1 over P, P equals 1 to cap P, xP squared minus 1 over B squared, d mu x equals 0. If the answer is 0, then the integrand is 0 almost everywhere. So that means that the limit of P going to infinity, 1 over P, summation P equals 1 to cap P, xP squared equals 1 over P. Now, strictly speaking, this limit is to be taken in this sense. This sense has a name. That's called the limit in mean. Limit in mean. In the mean. So that's the way
written limit dot L dot I dot M dot the limit in the mean. That means exactly that I tell you. Okay, so we have found a very interesting property of our support. This is like a sphere in p dimensions. As p gets bigger, it's a sphere in bigger dimensions. Now, if I multiply the capital P up on this side, then it becomes capital P over B. So the radius squared of this sphere is the number of degrees of freedom divided by the parameter B. And as the number of degrees of freedom goes toward infinity, the sphere becomes infinitely big. I grant you, the radius is huge, but it is nevertheless sensitive to the parameter B. And the essence of that conclusion is that the measure is supported on the sphere at infinity of characteristic radius squared with this B parameter. So the mu's actually depend on the parameter B. The support depends on B. And if I had two such measures, with different B values, two Gaussians of this kind with different B values, where would their support relative to each other would be? Would it be disjoint. Equivalent measures as they are in finitely many degrees of freedom?
It would be disjoint.
Disjoint. So this is mutually singular for different Bs. That's very, very, very different than what happens in finitely many degrees of freedom. Okay, we're going to go further.
Because what you're saying is that in finite dimensions, it's the regular Rn. And so
yes,
no matter what
yes.
the B is, it's always the same Rn.
That's right.
But now it's sort of this sphere yes. at infinity or
yes.
something.
Yes, yes, yes. And let's... If this surprises you, it surprised me when I first heard about it. Let me now tell you why it's obvious. And I think we have 2 minutes left to do that. The sequence we need, x1, x2, x3, xp, is an infinite sequence drawn from our various different measures, b over 2 x n squared. So sum 1 to n, then the normalization. Okay, capital N. Each one is drawn from a Gaussian distribution. Drawn from the first one, drawn from the second, drawn from the third, blah, 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 blah. But since all of these are identically chosen, it's equivalent to draw these numbers from the first Gaussian over and over and over again. So we're drawing x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared as numbers from a single Gaussian. And I am taking the ultimate average of these as b goes to infinity. But that is, by definition, the mean square of x in that distribution, just in a single Gaussian. And
that's the number one overview. This sum apparently depends on the x's, but in the limit as b goes to infinity, it's an invariant. It's a constant almost everywhere. It's not a random variable. Time's up. See you Friday.
What about our initial normalization where we considered that b can be greater than 2 pi or lesser than 2 pi or equal to 2 pi?
That's completely out the window because b over 2 pi raised to the infinity should not, that question should not be raised. Okay, and principle, homework is due on Friday. Unless you want to persuade me, because this is my weekend of my birthday, and I don't want to grade any homework this weekend, so why don't we delay it a little bit? Now, Monday. Vote to delay? A week. Monday, unfortunately, there's a conference in mathematics which I must attend, so Monday's class is canceled. Therefore, Wednesday is the next opportunity for homework, and I graciously assent to your request. Homework due on Wednesday.